the UK Financial Intelligence Unit, as a national remit to analyse information on economic crime received through suspicious activity reports. This is the Financial Intelligence Podcast, brought to you by the UK FIU. Hello, and welcome back to part two of our illegal wildlife trade episode. In part one, Investigative Support Officer Ian Guildford from the NWCU and Deputy Director of Intelligence Barry McCullop from the Canadian FIU FinTrack discussed illegal wildlife activity that is prevalent in the UK and Canada and the impact that it is having both economically and environmentally. In this episode, we will pick up looking at predicate crimes associated with the trade, key indicators for reporters, and the importance and value of international cooperation in tackling this global crime. Now, one thing that we've seen in past case studies is the quick movement of funds after receipt between accounts. This process of moving the money obtained on the sale of illegal wildlife through multiple transactions effectively cleans it of its illegitimate origin, making it look as though it's come from legitimate funds. As well as illicit monetary transactions, which predicate crimes are commonly seen alongside the illegal wildlife trade?
A lot of it is because it's through organized crime, whether it's Asian organized crime or other types of organized crime. Organized crime groups tend not to become specialists in one area. They're motivated by greed, they're motivated by money, and they will move whatever they can move illegally to make money. So whether it's illegal wildlife that they're moving, we will often see that they're using the same routes and the same people to move drugs, to move weapons, to move people. And to commit fraud against people, whether it's the elderly or other vulnerable people. Organized crime is not a specialist group. They will go after anything that they can make money with. And that's unfortunately what we're seeing in Canada as well. The same groups moving illegal firearms, for example, between Canada and the US will also facilitate the movement of illegal wildlife. They will also facilitate the movement of humans. And it really is, whether it's the drugs, whether it's anything, I think what I see with illegal wildlife trade is because it's done more openly, because right now I think that the organized crime groups see illegal wildlife trade as something that's relatively low risk, high reward, and they tend to do it more openly. They'll do it on open platforms where they'll be selling illegal wildlife because people don't know that it's illegal, for example. Which I think is perhaps a way in, if you follow the money on the illegal wildlife trade, it is a way in, I believe, to the organized crime groups to disrupt their other activities as well. So I think just having our reporting entities being able to flag these transactions may be one additional way for law enforcement to get after the organized crime groups, whether it's in Canada or, as we know, these organized crime groups tend to be transnational and international in scope. So it is very important, I believe, that we go after the illegal wildlife trade, if for no other reason than to disrupt the other activities that the organized crime groups are undertaking on a daily basis.
And is that the same for the UK, Ian? Are we seeing the cross-criminality of the organised crime groups, or are they specialist operations?
No, as Barry says, you're definitely seeing the crossovers. There's no doubt about it. It's run by organised crime groups, and organised crime groups will look at something which will make money, whether it be through drugs, whether it be people trafficking, whatever it is. And as Barry said, wildlife crime, international wildlife trade, is high return, low risk. It is. It's not something which a lot of the enforcement authorities historically have actually been picking up on and targeting. So you're much more likely when coming through an airport to be picked up with a cache of drugs or whatever in your luggage as you are to have a concealed wildlife consignment in there. I can give you an example, or two examples, of how the connections are there. The eel trade, the glass eel trade of running glass eels out to Asia, is run very, very similar to exactly as drugs smuggling is concerned, in the fact you're using paid mules. So paid mules are coming over from China. They're paid to come over to mainland Europe for a holiday. They're then supplied with a suitcase, ordinary tourist suitcase, and that suitcase will be packed full of live glass eels. They'll be put into plastic bags, filled with water, aerated and put in with a frozen water bottle to keep the temperature down. And then they're paid then to put them onto commercial flights and take them back to, probably not directly to China, but Vietnam, Korea, various locations. Hong Kong is, used to be a popular route going out. So there you can see it's exactly the same method as used by the drug smugglers. The other example that really raised it to myself was we had a conviction a good few years ago now of a gentleman who was basically smuggling glass eels out to China via the countries that I mentioned. The investigation, when we looked at the investigation and the records that he kept, obviously we look at people's phones these days, we look at downloads, and we were seeing that he was basically, he was a commodity dealer. We were seeing things like, this could be legal, it could be illegal, but we were saying, he had a text come through, I got 500 cars in Namibia, can you shift them for me? I got gold bars coming out of South Africa, can you find a buyer for me? So he was a commodity dealer, and he found that he could make some very good money out of the smuggling of glass eels with a very little low risk, and it was about 4 years worth. And he eventually made £53 million worth out of just smuggling the glass eels. In addition to that, the worrying thing was one of the conversations, and I won't go into who was involved in the conversation, but it went along the lines of, I've got a load of wood to move out of West Africa. Can you find me a boat? Yes, I can find you a boat. Yes, but what about the port? What, will I get any issues in the port? Oh, don't worry about that. I own the port. And all of a sudden, you can suddenly see the scale of what wildlife crime is. And that's what we try and get across to enforcement bodies. It's very much historically, it's the green grass poaching sort of scenario. Oh, that's wildlife crime. A couple of egg thefts. No, this is organized crime on a major scale and a major financial profits to be made by the criminals. So it will run alongside other crime because those are the people that are dealing with it.
That's huge. So based on the suspicious activity reports that the UK FIU has received relating to IWT, we've seen many instances where the UK is a source country, such as, for example, the trading of falcons and the glass eels to the Middle East and Asia. I think what you've just given me is an example of a case whereby the UK is used as a transit destination. Barry, is this something that you see in Canada as well?
Unfortunately, it is. You know, I think our economies are both solid. We have solid banks, whether it's in Canada or the UK. We have a very solid banking framework that unfortunately also plays well into the hands of the criminals. If you're looking at how do we move money, and we've seen it as well in Canada, where we'll have Canadian importers being used as financial intermediaries, for example, for wildlife trafficking, where they'll receive funds from ultimate recipients and then send funds to suppliers in other countries. One such example is an individual in Canada who sent funds to an entity in the US, followed by a transfer of funds from an import-export entity, a legitimate import-export entity in China, for a similar dollar value, suggesting the individual is actually importing wildlife only to re-export it overseas. And we see that in Canada a lot. We will be a transit country, contrary to some of the drugs where we may be a source country. Unfortunately, on the wildlife trade, we are a source country, but we're also our transit country. And a lot of that, you know, we're a big country. We have lots of ports. We have lots of entry points. We have a solid financial framework in Canada. And people are unfortunately taking advantage of that, as they do with other crimes.
And Ian, can you tell me a little bit more about how the UK is used as a transit destination?
In transit, quite often we're seeing shipments, probably derivatives are coming in, as I mentioned, the reptile skins coming in, and then we see them being then sold out. If someone sees a commodity where they can make a profit, they will buy it in. We've had alligator heads, which are openly for sale in the US down in Florida. And they've been shipped in via the back door into the UK. And again, he was then selling them at double the price he was buying them for. And they were going out all over the world. So yes, it's a common theme where we see where wildlife is a product. And if you can make a profit from it, people will do it.
And as you mentioned previously, Ian, one of the challenges with IWT is the ability to obscure illegal trade through legal trade, as some of the species can be sold legitimately, but within set parameters. What are some of the key indicators and red flags that reporters should be looking out for in spotting potential IWT-related suspicious activity and transaction reports, Barry?
There are a number of them, and certainly our Project Anton Operations Alert has all these indicators, and they were developed internationally, so they're not just specific to Canada. But some of the indicators that we're looking at and are the transaction details themselves, the remittance information, the information that's written down when somebody sends money from themselves to someone else or receives money. There's email addresses, remittance information that talks to and speaks to, and as I said earlier, a lot of this is done in the open. So they'll actually make references to species of animal parts that are of concern for legal wildlife trade. So they'll have a reference to eels, perhaps, in the remittance information, or reference to the import of something or the export of goods, fisheries, wholesales. They'll talk about, they'll have a reference to a pet store. They may own a pet store. We've seen remittance information where they actually put down it's for scales or it's for tortoise, or because some of these people don't think that there's a very high risk of them getting caught. And this is much more open. You will rarely see somebody sending money to somebody else to say, hey, this is for fentanyl. But they will, in fact, put down that it may be for one of our wildlife species that they're looking after at buying or selling. We also see information that identifies the individual or the as an owner or an operator or an employee associated with an industry that could be used to facilitate illegal wildlife trade. So import, export of goods, they may run a pet store, they may own a freight company, they may be in animal control. And a lot of that is identifiable through the know your client information that banks have. We've seen frequent transfers to individuals or entities located in jurisdictions of concern. That is one that should be a red flag. If you see many individuals sending transfers or many transfers to places like China, Hong Kong, sub-Saharan Africa, and they're living in Canada, the UK, you should be questioning why they're doing this. These are red flags. We've seen payments received from individuals or entities involved in animal-related businesses, aquariums, and as Ian mentioned, the crossover and the blurring sometimes between the illegal and illegal, where you see an aquarium or a zoo or a legitimate pet store, but what they're purchasing is inconsistent with their profile, or the amount that they're purchasing is inconsistent with the profile or what you would expect of a pet store. These are all transactions that are visible in financial institutions. And the Ops Alert, what we try to do is provide indicators that are actionable enough that the reporting entities can actually create algorithms based on these to flag and assist them in their transaction monitoring. I know that banks will see millions upon millions of transactions daily. It's really important that the algorithms be set up appropriately so that they can identify and have use technology to flag these transactions as they go through, so that you can then have a human look at this and make a determination on whether or not to submit an STR or an SAR to the financial intelligence unit. So the transaction monitoring indicators are specific to the illegal wildlife trade, which is good, and I'm really happy that we were able to identify those and make them a little more specific so they're not linked to just general crime. And these are really the indicators that the financial institutions around the world can use to help flag these transactions and proactively, to a certain extent, identify those people that perhaps law enforcement are not yet aware of who are committing these heinous crimes, whether it's illegal wildlife or other crimes that they're committing. It is really the goal of the operational alerts and the development of these indicators. And we will update these indicators. Probably we try to do it every 18 months, but with an international PPP such as Project Anton, we've actually been adding different indicators and different words that people are using to describe eels, for example, in many, many different languages in our FIU toolkit that is shared internationally as well. So we've seen some success and we're hoping for a lot more based on the use of these indicators around the world.
Thank you. And Ian?
I think I can virtually repeat what has just been said. Keywording words are very important in trying to pick this trade up. But like everything, it doesn't take long for the criminal to know that we're onto that keyword and the word changes. Just for example, it's not really in relation to this, but eBay used to have a ban on ivory sales. So if you put the word ivory in, it would be taken down. It then moved from ivory, it moved to cow bone. Then it moved to bone or faux ivory. And you could see the trends. As eBay took it down, the wording would change. And that would be exactly the same. But keywording is, in relation to this, very important. I think from our perspective as a law enforcement agency, it's acknowledging that traditional policing methods don't work. We've got to look outside the box. We've got to look at the financial issue side of things, hence why we run financial investigations alongside wildlife crime ones. And again, it's going back to the fact that it's all concealed, quite a lot of it. Well, not all, but a lot of it is concealed within the lawful trade, which does make it a lot harder because from a financial point of view, if you're looking at the trading, you're seeing lawful trading. But then it's the fact that there's an illegal trade within that legal trade makes it even harder to pick up. So again, as Barry says, you're looking at the wording, you're looking at the source countries, you're looking at which way the flows are going, looking at some of the companies and the values concerned. It's looking at all of these pointers to try and pick them up. We had one very recently, which was a very strange one, and it came in as a report, but we looked at it. And it was a pet shop in the UK trading with someone in India, yet we expected the money to be big payments going to India for supply of reptiles or whatever, the wildlife from India. It was the other way round. It was going from India to the UK. And when queried, it was backed up with a really strange one of one single species going for a price which was nowhere near what that trade price was. It was hundreds of thousands over. It was a stupid price. And also, it was a shipment of crickets. But it was such a high price that virtually you could have filled a warehouse with the amount of crickets for that price. So straight away, the alarm bells went off. So that was just one good example of looking at that and thinking, that doesn't work out. It's very difficult for the financial side of it, because if you're in the wildlife trade or in the wildlife crime business, you know what these are. It's very difficult on the financial side to pick it up, but it's just looking for those key pointers, really.
Last year, both the UK and Canada were among a number of international financial intelligence units who signed the Statement of Principles for a Multilateral Approach to Combating Illegal Wildlife Trade at a summit convened by United for Wildlife, which was created by Prince William and the Royal Foundation. What are your thoughts on why international collaboration is key to the fight against IWT, Ian?
From our perspective, it's like any approach to wildlife crime. From enforcement, you can't do it on your own. The whole approach to dealing and combating the illegal wildlife trade is a partnership approach. And this is just another example of how this is being taken forward. Historically, again, I joined the police force a long, long time ago, and police forces were very insular and didn't like working with outside agencies. Thankfully, that has changed now, and we've got to work together towards it. And the signing of this agreement is a big step forward in helping us deal with that.
Thank you. And Barry?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, the illegal wildlife trade is big, big business for organized crime. Estimates put the illegal wildlife trade at between $20 to $50 billion U.S. dollars a year. That puts it as the fourth largest generator of funds for organized crime, just right behind human trafficking. It is a significant issue, and it is global in nature. As Ian said, you can't do it on your own within a country. A country can't do it alone without working with other countries. It's a global phenomenon. It's a global issue. And if it's a global crime, it requires a global response. We have great partnerships around the world. We're developing better partnerships or developing more partnerships to address this crime. The Statement of Principles, I think, gives a nice focus on using the financial intelligence to combat this type of crime. You know, we've seen, I think, the UNODC, so the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime in 2020, identified, I think, 150 countries that had been seen and identified as suspected illegal wildlife traffickers. If you have 150 countries that have been identified by the UNODC, one country alone or two countries alone can't address this issue. We need a global response to this issue if we want to eventually eradicate this, but actually be able to keep some biodiversity in our world so that our grandchildren's grandchildren can actually see some of these species. We really need to work together. And I think between things like the Project Anton, public-private partnerships, the Statement of Principles, these are all coming together, I think, to assist us globally in addressing this type of crime.
And that concludes our discussion for the day. Many thanks to Ian and Barry for joining us and shedding light on this crucial subject. FinTrack's operational alert on laundering the proceeds of crime from illegal wildlife trade can be found linked in this episode's description. And thank you, the audience, for tuning in and listening. We hope that you found this episode insightful and informative. And don't forget to follow us on the UKFIU's LinkedIn and X pages for up-to-date news and product releases. Until next time, goodbye.